Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
Okay, Bob Dylan called him the greatest folk rock singer on the planet. He took the first lead role in the original Broadway production of Hair. He is one of the very few artists who can say that they knocked the Beatles off from number one spot on the charts, and his publicist even says that he's the very first hippie in the world. He sung a happy little tune that you might remember too.
But you tell me
welcome to Open House.
Thank you, thank you. Yeah, that's a nice little breakfast song to hear, isn't it? Or dinner, after-dinner tune. Yeah.
How do you feel, actually, all these years later, being associated with a song that is
I still sing it every. I'll sing it in my show, every show I do here in Australia. I sing it every show I do anywhere in the world. Because, tragically, the song appears to be more accurate today than it was in 1965 when it was first recorded.
Yeah.
There are, you know, I mean, this, I don't have the hard figures, but I get the feeling that there are more people being violently torn to shreds per minute as we speak here on this radio show than were being torn to shreds per minute back in the summer of 65 when the song was first recorded. There's more political mistrust. There's more military insanity. You know, there's more racial hatred. You know, I mean, nothing has changed. There's more, you know, spiritual hypocrisy. And the song, they labeled the song a protest song, but it really wasn't protesting anything. It was, hey, man.
You really were raising questions, weren't you?
It was a diagnostic. The song is a societal diagnostic of worldwide hypocrisy. That's all it was.
Well, welcome to Australia.
You know? Well, thank
you. It's great to have you here. It's great to have you in the studios of Open House as well.
Oh, this is great.
Were you the world's first hippie?
Well, that's what I don't know if I was a, you know, people put title. I didn't even know I was a hippie. And one day I was in Sausalito up in San Francisco, and I just walked out of we used to call them head shops, you know. And I just walked out the door, and I'm standing there, and I've got on my my pants that I made that are all flowers and swirling, and a, you know, vest and a jacket or whatever. I don't know how that hair is blowing in the wind. And right at that time, a tour bus came by. And, you know, they can always hear the person standing in front telling all the people on the bus, and here we are in Sausalito, and over on the left is a such and such, and over on the right. And just as I walked in, I'm standing there watching the bus go by, she says, and, oh, there's one now. And everybody on the bus looked at me. And I waved at them. So I guess, you know, and they called us hippies. We were just a bunch of people looking for answers.
Well, I think this is going to be the exciting thing about having you in the studio is exploring some of that journey that you've been through, because it is quite a journey, a musical journey, a spiritual journey. We're going to get to that in just a
good
second
stuff.
As well. Tell me about your first paid gig, though, because everybody knows Barry McGuire, the musician. Tell me about that very first time you realized, oh, I'm a professional musician.
Oh, well, I didn't realize I was a professional musician even when I got paid. I had a date with a girl, Valerie Farrell, and she was beautiful. And I was so excited. And so I showed up. I thought the date was I'm going to pick her up at 8 o'clock. And there I showed up. Man, I had a little red Jag Roadster and a big bouquet of flowers. I picked up roses and I knocked on the door. Nobody's home. And I knocked again. Nobody's home. And I looked in the window. The apartment is dark. And I thought, God, man, she stood me up. So I got really upset. 3 or 4 years later, I found out the date was for 7 o'clock. So by 7:30, she was out of there. She said, who's this guy? I think he is. But so I went over to my uncle's. He had a bar in Santa Monica there, Sterling's, and I went to Sterling's, and I'm sitting there, you know, drinking my blues away, and the piano player was there, and he's playing. So I went over and sat at the piano bar, and I'm singing along with him, and he's singing, and I'm singing with him, and he said, hey, man, you can sing pretty good. He says, and I said, yeah. I said, I play the guitar. And I'd only been playing the guitar for about, well, maybe 4 months at the time, 5 months. He says, well, you got it with you? I said, well, yeah, it's out in my car. He said, go get it and bring it in. So I went and got the guitar and brought it in. I'm sitting there with him, and he would play a few songs. He said, sing something. And I'd sing, and he'd play and sing. Well, by the end of the evening, by 2 o'clock in the morning when the bar closed, we were both pretty light on our feet and just kind of floating. And the waitress came over. She says, listen, this girl's having a birthday party, one of the waitresses, and we're going to go over to her house afterwards and have a big party and ask the piano player if he'd like to come along. And he said, well, yeah, my friend Barry can come. He's a black guy, just a great guy. What a piano player. So we all went over to the party. And he was heavy alcoholic because he got so whacked on alcohol that he actually went to sleep on the living room floor with all the sheet music on his chest.
Is that right?
happy man. Yeah. And I wound up playing the guitar and singing, and I had no idea, you know. I was just singing folk songs, you know, and Kingston Trio songs, Harry Belafonte songs, and down the way where the nights are gay and the sun shines deep. I mean, just wonderful sing-along songs. I just loved singing them. I loved the words and the pictures they painted in my head. And wound up everybody at the party. There was no place for my guitar. There were so many people there. So I wound up under the dining room table, playing my guitar under the dining room table. And then everybody started coming, sitting around the table. And pretty soon the whole dining room was full of people sitting on the floor and standing in the living room looking. And they were all singing along, you know, just sailing across the river from Liverpool. Heave away, way up she rises, way up. She, you know, just a great party songs. Yeah. Well, about a week later, I got a telephone call. A guy says, listen, I was at so-and-so's birthday party the other night, and, my piano player didn't make it. Could you come and sing in my restaurant? He had a bar restaurant, you know. And I said, well, I only know about five or six songs all the way through. He said, I don't care. Just come and do what you did at the parties. I'll give you $50 cash, and you probably make a few tips, too. $50? Man, oh, I'll be right down. So I called my friends. I said, listen, I'm going to be singing down here at the Bavarian Chalet. It was right on the corner of Sunset Boulevard and Pacific Coast Highway. And down I went. I got there about 9:30 and started singing. I sang for, say, 9, 10, 11, 12, 1. I sang for 5 hours, 45-minute sets. I only knew 5 songs all the way through. And people were running to the telephone call. You got to get down here, man. There's a guy singing. He's going to knock you out. And it was the best cash register night this guy'd ever had.
Right.
And it was just a fluke. Yeah. And he says, man, he says, if you can come back next week, he says, I'll give you $100. And I made about $70 in tips that night.
And back then, that's a lot of money.
That was like $700 today. Mm. So I bought myself another Kingston Trio album and a Bobby Dylan album.
Learned a few more songs.
Another Harold. Yes, right, man. I'm working on new songs all week long and trying to write a few too. And that's how it started. Just wow. And then other club owners came in.
The beginning of big things to come. This is Open House right across Australia, and Barry Maguire is our guest. Some amazing stories I bet you have. You've hung out with the Beatles, Crosby, Stills and Nash, the Birds.
Yeah.
All sorts of people. Yeah.
People you meet and things you do, and you don't
know. Who would you have considered your closest friends, you know,
during
high
those
role?
Years, well, it started off, it was David Crosby and I were really close in the early days. Hoyt Axton and I, we wrote Greenback Dollar sitting on a... you know, on washing machines waiting for our clothes to come out of the dryer. You know, I don't know if people remember Joy to the World, all the boys. That was Hoyt's song. Mm. And one time I asked Hoyt, I said, what does that song mean? He says, well, he says, I don't know, man. He says, I wrote it in a recording studio. He says, I did 11 songs. They needed another tune. He says, I don't have another. He said, well, just write one. So he wrote that song in the studio, singing it on the microphone. I said, well, what does it mean? He said, man, when you write a song in 3 minutes, you don't know what it means. I don't have a clue. And he did have a next-door neighbor, a little boy that had a bullfrog named Jeremiah.
Yeah.
Was a good friend of mine. You know, Jeremiah was a bullfrog.
Yeah.
He's a good friend of mine. You know, he just made it up.
How many of the songs of the 60s really don't have meanings?
Oh, I don't know. One time I was sitting, Dylan was playing the piano. I was sitting there on the stool next to him, just the two of us in his house. And I don't know where everybody else was, but it was just... And he was playing. He said, what do you think of this? And he's singing a song to me. Oh, man. He said, you know, people are, he sang some words to me. He says, people are always asking me what my songs mean. He said, I don't know what they mean. He said, I just like the way the words fit together. It's like paint. And they just kind of blur and come together. And they cause you to feel things, you know. How does this make you feel? And he would sing a song, you know.
Jumping topics then, because here is a song that really did mean something, was Eve of Destruction.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, written by Phil Sloan. But it was your expression of the words that really made it what it became. Yeah. What was going through your mind and soul when you were in the studio recording?
Well, this is gonna blow all your imagination here, because it's... We had a 3-hour recording session. The way I got the date was the Birds were opening at Ciro's, and Roger McGuinn, Gene Clark, Dave Crosby, Chris Hillman, Michael Clark, the Birds, and they were all friends. And in fact, I was really upset because Tambourine Man, I wanted to do that tune, and Roger got to it before I did, and that was their first single release. And so here it is, opening night, they're doing Tambourine Man, Turn, Turn, Bells of Rumney, all the great songs that they did. And I was dancing on the dance floor, just out bouncing around, just sweating and swinging and twirling and jumping. And I hear some, hey, McGuire. And so I jumped over and danced in that direction. And it's this guy, Lou Adler, who's a record producer. I didn't know him from Adam. He says, what are you doing these days? I said, I'm dancing. He says, well, no. He says,
you had to be told that.
Yeah. He's, He says, no, no, are you singing? I said, no, I'm dancing. He said, well, sit down. So I sat down. He bought me a beer. And he said, well, are you singing for anybody? I said, no, 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 I'd like to. But, you know, I just left the Christy Minstrels and 4 years on, 3 years on the road. He says, well, this is Phil Sloan. And Dylan was sitting at the table. And that's where I first met Bobby, first face to face. And he says, you know, Phil Sloan has written some really great tunes. Would you like to, you know, come over and play them? Yeah, okay. So he gave me his phone number. And I danced off into the night and I lost the phone number before I left the building. I mean, that's just my MO. My wife calls me a magician. And Terry, my singing partner, he says, McGuire's a magician. He makes things disappear. Watch. I'll give him the directions to where we're going. And look, they're gone. Where are the directions? I don't know. And we one time we stopped the car and searched the whole car, and they weren't there anymore. But anyway, I lost the telephone number, and I got a phone call of 3 or 4 days later. He tracked me down out in North Hollywood, someplace I was staying. McGuire, you didn't come to see me. I said, I lost the phone number. He said, I figured as much. He says, what are you doing right now? I said, nothing. He says, can I send a car for you? Oh, yeah, okay. So he sent a car, got me, and took me back to his office. And Phil sang these songs, and I really liked the songs that he wrote. So, and I really liked Eve of Destruction because it just resonated in me. There's truth in this song. This song has truth in it. And so we set a recording date. A couple of weeks later, we were in recording. We had a three-hour session. And we had finished two songs. The third song sounded kind of like the first song. So Lou said, let's do something else. This sounds like... So I said, I pulled the words to Eve of Destruction out of my back pocket. You know, Phil had just ripped them out of his notebook, handwritten, and given them to me. And so I'd gone over it a couple of times. I said, let's do this Eve of Destruction tune. I really like this one. So I smoothed out all the wrinkles and put it on the music stand. And there was a drummer, guitar player, bass player. And that was it, three-piece band and me in the corner. And they went through it about three times. It's a four-chord song, easy. So, okay, let's do it. And we only had 20 minutes left in this session. So we recorded it. And we went in and listened to the playback. And there's a place in the original recording goes, ah, you can't twist the truth. And the reason I'm going, is because I lost my place in the wrinkly paper. I couldn't. And people said, man, you sounded so frustrated when you... I said, well, I was. I couldn't read the words. It was dark. And you know, the first time I was just trying to get
not
into
so
the
much
tune.
Existential angst as much as no. I can't find my lyrics.
I can't read the lyrics. So I wanted to come back in and re-record the vocal track. And that was on a Thursday. Well, Friday, this guy, Ernie Farrell, came by Lou's office, and he had an acetate, you know, of the song, which is just like a little vinyl record, but you can only play it about five times, and it loses its fidelity. And so he picked up these acetates and didn't tell Lou, and he was a guy that took records around to radio stations and you know, pushed records. And the KFWB was the number one rock station in L.A. at the time. And the guy that was the program director for the station, his daughter was having a birthday party, and Ernie Farrell was a professional photographer, and he was shooting her birthday party. And he went out to get some flash bulbs, and he saw this acetate laying there that he just took from Lou's office. And he said, well, I'll play these for the kids and see what they think. So he took them in and played them for the kids, and they played one, they played another, and then they played Eve, and the whole party stopped. Mm-hmm. Stopped the party. Play that one again. Oh, man. Oh, man. And the girl grabbed it off the turn, Daddy, and went running into his office. Listen to this. So he listened to it, and he called Lou right there and said, listen, you mastered this. Mix it and master it and press it. He said, I'll go on it Monday morning as I picked a hit. Mm-hmm. So here I recorded on Thursday, like 4 days later, at 7 o'clock in the morning, I get a telephone call from Dunhill Records. Jay Lasker says, McGuire, turn on KFWB. And I went, turned the radio on, and there's my song on the radio. And it's just a poof, it hit number one, just kaboom.
It really exploded, didn't it?
Exploded. In fact, there was a thing that came out about 6-8 months later, and all the DJs in America got this memo not to play anything that I did next.
Well, I wanted to get to that, because while it exploded and became this giant single for you, it made you famous, it actually destroyed your career forevermore, didn't
it? One of the reasons, and I don't know, this is hearsay. Because Eve became a number one tune, and not one disc jockey in America made a penny off of it. Anyway, they said, don't play anything McGuire plays because he's a loose cannon and we can't have anything like this in the industry. So that was the end of me.
Wow.
Which was cool, because if I'd have got another hit record, I'd be just as dead as John Phillips or Denny Doherty or Cass Elliott or Hoyt Axton or, you know, all the people.
Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix,
you know,
Jim Morrison.
All those people that I performed with and partied with and sang with, I'd be... might be history.
Yeah. Barry Maguire is our guest on Open House tonight. Why would you be? How bad did the drugs and the lifestyle get?
I have no idea how bad it got. It just got tombstone territory. It was death row. It was, everything was dead. I was dead. The people I hung with were all empty inside. I remember the last lady I was with, my lady of the night, and there we were, intimately involved, and I remember looking into her eyes, and I just saw two black holes staring at me, and I stopped what we were doing, and I went into the bathroom and threw water in my face, and I looked in the mirror, and the same two black holes were staring out of my face. There was nothing, nobody home. It was just like two cadavers clutching at each other, you know, trying to reach some orgasmic thing that would, energy, something, am I alive? Prove to me, hit me, punch me, you know, do something to me.
So I can feel something.
So I can feel something. I mean, even if it's painful, hurt me, do anything, just to let me know that I'm, that recognize my existence, you know, that I exist. And and during that time, I'd finished doing Hair on Broadway. You know, I did that for about a year, and I realized that Hair had a lot of spiritual answers. I went on a spiritual search. When I left the Christy Minstrels, I'd seen all these people that had made so much money and were so empty and had no life fulfillment. And I'd recorded Eve of Destruction, had no answers in it. So I went looking for the answer. I wound up doing Hair on Broadway, playing the male lead in the show. And after about 8-9 months, I realized this is empty. And all of our friends, you know, over a 10-year period, I lost 16 of my friends through drug overdose and suicide.
16.
And sexually transmitted diseases, died from AIDS, died from, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll is a lot of fun. But at the end of the party, when the piper comes to pick up his pay, he takes your life with him when he walks out the door.
So you start on this spiritual journey. You start seeking these answers, which your own song couldn't actually answer yet. And you went through a whole realm of different things. You spent a bit of time in a commune in Santa Fe.
I did that. Yeah, I went to Santa Fe looking for answers. Hung out with the Hopi Indians, ate peyote.
Sai Baba.
My friends did Sai Baba, you know, and Yogi Bhajan. We belonged to, I joke about it. I said, we all belonged to the Guru of the Month Club there in Hollywood. Whoever came through, we'd run down and try his thing. And everybody was seriously searching for foundational truth, and I didn't see any fulfillment in what they were doing. They didn't seem to be happy either.
A little good news Bible makes its way into your life.
I was at Danny Doherty's house at my 18 months, and he always had a big bowl of marijuana under the coffee table, and it was always full. I don't know where it came from. I never asked. But every morning I was there rolling up a big joint. And this one morning I'm there, and there's this little paperback book, Good News for Modern Man. There it was on the coffee table. And I said, hey, I'm a modern man. I'm rolling a big Conestoga joint. And I thought, boy, I could use some good news. All my friends are dying. And so I took it to my room, opened it up, and it says, the New Testament in Modern English. And I thought, oh, man, them Jesus freaks are disguising the Bible. You know, how sneaky can you get here? And I didn't want to read the Bible. And it just, you know, threw it on the floor. It laid there for days. And finally, just really out of sarcastic curiosity, what is this Jesus thing all about, man? So I picked it up and started to read. I was bored, you know. And I discovered the teachings of Christ as I compared his words to what I knew to be true through my own life experience. I could find no fault. I couldn't break his. There was no deception, hidden agenda. Everything was clean.
Was there one phrase of Jesus that really caught you?
Absolutely.
What was it?
I'm not going to tell you. No, I'm not telling you. I'm just teasing.
You tease.
He said, they asked him what the greatest law was. And he says, to love God with all your heart, mind, soul, strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. And I went, oh, man, that was the answer. That's it. How simple can it be? Hmm. I mean, that was the hippie creed. Love, love, love. All we need is love. But we didn't know.
I was going to say, what is the difference, though?
We didn't know. Well, the difference is that to love your neighbor as yourself means that you don't violate your neighbor's dignity. You know, you don't sleep with your neighbor's wife or your neighbor's daughter. You don't, you know, steal your neighbor's car or his money or his property. You know, you treat your neighbor as, like, I saw Hugh Hefner on TV one time. In a Dick Cavett show, And Dick asked him, he says, well, tell me, Hugh, when is your daughter going to join the, you know, put on a bunny suit and join the party? Mm-hmm. And Hefner went through a little shift and change and puffed on his pipe. He says, well, you know, he says, there's the one area in my philosophy I've never been able to work out. He says, I don't want my daughter to be a bunny.
Wow.
And as soon as he said those words, man, pow, I realized that God's law is written on Hugh Hefner's heart. See, he wants to do to other men's little girls what he doesn't want other men to do to his own
That's
little
right.
girl.
That's right.
So he's a living hypocrite. He'll never be able to stand before the creator being that spoke the universe into existence and say, I didn't know what I was doing was wrong.
That's true.
Because his own heart will tell him.
So you're reading this Good News Bible.
Yes.
You've come across.
We got ahead of the story.
We can go anywhere with this conversation, can't we? And so you're reading this Good News Bible.
Yeah.
You're coming across the teachings of Jesus.
Yeah.
He comes alive for you. But is there a point where you cross the line as us Christians kind of want to say,
I saw Christ and I thought, I want to be like this guy. This guy's just laid it down so plain and so simple. You know, and yet, and also, it's like, here's my parable, and this is the truth. I was sitting on death row. I had a number in my hand. And, you know, 16 of my friends, they'd already called their number. They had gone down the corridor to pay the piper, and they were not on the planet any longer. And I'm waiting for my number to be called, just like theirs was. And I look down on the floor, and flutter, 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 a little piece of paper, and I pick it up, and it's written in blood, and it says, Crimes Paid For in Full, Barry McGuire. And at the bottom it's signed, in blood, Jesus Christ. Hmm. Crimes eternally paid for. So I've got a pardon in one hand and a number in the other. Now what am I going to do? I mean, I'm a high school dropout, but I'm not that dumb. So I threw the number away and I took that pardon and I real folded it up and tucked it into my heart. And when I looked up, I saw there's no door on the cell. Death row. No door on the cell. I stood up and there was no cell. And I walked away free, clean, before my God, innocent forever.
Did it cost you much?
Cost
to
me nothing,
make that decision?
Nothing. Nothing.
Even amongst your colleagues, though?
Guy told me one time, he says, how did you give everything up? How did you give up the drugs and the girls and the, you know? I says, you know, that's like a guy, an Eskimo, who hits the lotto, and he goes to Miami Beach, and he sends a video of himself back from Miami Beach, and he's got a bathing suit on, and he's laying there in the bathing suit, and everybody in Alaska is in their igloos with their parkas, and they're, you know, freezing, you know, 80 below zero, and they see this video of him in his bathing suit, and they say, oh, how did he give up his parka? Yeah. He didn't give it up. He got rid of it. He got rid of all those things. It's like leeches. Fame, fortune, money, girls, drugs. It's like leeches sucking the life out of you. You don't give them up. Guy told me one time, he says, Jesus is a crutch. I said, no, Jesus is the bone, my friend. When he comes into your legs, you throw the crutches away. All of that stuff is crutches that prop us up who we think we are. That's not who we are. I mean, if you're on death row, you're still somebody's son or daughter. You know, if you're a murderer, hey, I'm a murderer. I paid for two abortions. You know, one time John Gotti, when he first got arrested and went to prison, and I have a friend of mine, and he's from the Italian family out of Detroit that used to be the Purple Gang back in the 20s with his great-grandfather. And I was talking with him, with Joe, and I said, man, can you believe John Gotti, man? They finally got, the guy's a drug dealer and prostitution and, you know, all of this, murderer. And he says, he says, kind of like us, huh? The only difference between me and John Gotti, or me and Adolf Hitler, is the blood of Jesus in 20, 30 years of walking in that forgiveness of Christ. That's what Christ gives us.
Well,
freedom.
Barry, it has been fascinating to talk to you. Thanks for joining us on Open House tonight.
Thank you, Sheridan. I remembered your name.
You did. Barry McGuire there, who has been touring Australia this week and is basically jumping onto a plane very soon, but you're going to be back in September.
September, we're planning it. You know, I stopped coming to Australia. I didn't think anybody down here really wanted to hear me anymore, and I've been having such a great time just talking with people, and there's such an open honesty in Australia that quite frankly, I don't receive in the United States. You know, there's just a real to listen and consider, you know, and you don't have to agree with me, but at least consider what I'm saying. We've been invited back to do more tours, and last night we just put together a 5-year plan to keep coming to the little towns and then the big cities and then go do our show in all the small towns. So it's a great adventure.
BarryMaguire.com will, I guess, keep us up to date.
Yeah, it will.
Barry Maguire, thanks for your time.
Thank you, man.
We hope you enjoy this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.